You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. January 1st, of course, marks a new year, but it also marks the beginning of higher bills if you're a PG&E customer. As of yesterday, PG&E bills will go up on average $33 a month. PG&E says it needs the money to pay for undergrounding lines in wildfire-prone areas, among other safety improvements. But this rate hike follows a series of increases in recent years and might not be the only one in store for 2024. Just weeks after the current increase was approved by the CPUC, that's the California Public Utilities Commission, PG&E requested for another one to take effect later this year. If that gets approved, ratepayers can expect an additional $12 a month tacked onto their bill on top of the $33 on average that begins this month. So why is this happening? And what happens to people who can't afford the increases? And are there alternatives to rate hikes? We reached out to PG&E and they were unable to join us this morning, but we do have two guests today. Mark Toney is the executive director of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, that is a ratepayer advocacy organization. And Meredith Fowley is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and the faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas. Good morning. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Meredith, I want to start with you because we had you on back in November, and this was ahead of the CPUC's meeting that eventually it approved the rate hikes, which kicked in yesterday on January 1. So let's just set the table by explaining what that rate hike was. What was it for back in November?
Yeah. So, and maybe taking even a bigger step back just to remind everyone sort of what's going on here. So PG&E is a regulated utility, right? Which means it can't just decide how much to charge its customers. It needs to sort of ask permission from the Public Utility Commission, as you mentioned. And then the CPUC reviews that request and decides whether it's warranted and if not, how it's going to adjust that request. So back in November, we had one of the largest rate cases I can remember. Mark can maybe remember larger ones, but in my memory, this was a big one. PG&E had initially proposed to increase its revenue requirement by like $15.4 billion. And as you mentioned, that would increase bills significantly. After hearing comments and arguments, including really important arguments from Mark and his colleagues at TURN, the CPUC reduced that request by about $1 billion. So they approved a revenue requirement that would increase bills by about 13% versus 18%. And as we talked about, and we can get into this, there were many sort of drivers. This is a pretty complex collection of imperatives that we're talking about in terms of what's driving the rate increases. But the top of the list, at least top of my list, we'll be interested to hear from Mark, is mitigating the risk of catastrophic wildfire and the costs associated with undergrounding in particular. But we're also talking about improving reliability and preparing for increases in customer load growth. And that's sort of part and parcel of our efforts to decarbonize, because we're really hoping households and firms will electrify. That means more customers and an increased importance for reliable supply.
So wildfire safety and also, you know, the big push by the state to electrify the state and to push more towards away from gas and more towards electricity. You mentioned that PG&E originally asked for more money and the CPUC approved a lesser amount. But then weeks later, the PG&E is now requesting an additional $2 billion rate increase from the CPUC. The CPUC has not voted on that yet. So did that come as a surprise to you, given that a rate increase was already approved just weeks prior?
I'm interested to hear what Mark says. I wasn't completely surprised, because when the PUC issued its decision, the PG&E said, that's not enough. We've got these significant investments that we need to make in wildfire safety and wildfire risk mitigation. And what you just approved doesn't cover what it's going to cost us. And there are also, and we don't have to get too deep into the weeds, but there are sort of adjustments that PG&E can ask for, even under an existing case, saying actually it cost us more than we anticipated. And so we're coming back to you to cover those unanticipated costs.
If these additional funds get approved, are they essentially going to go towards, you know, the same mission to reduce wildfire risk and also to support, you know, an increased electrification, you know, across the state?
Yep. So, I mean, the devil's in the details, but wildfire for me is top of mind. Reliability more generally it costs money to improve reliability. And I think the overarching idea here that I think we need to keep top of mind is that it does cost money to provide safe, reliable, sustainable power supply. And as we mentioned before, I mean, January 1st, we all make New Year's resolutions. I think if there's two, for me, the question is not whether it's going to cost more. It's going to cost more, but cost containment and affordability. You know, we really, if we want to meet these objectives, we need to lean into thinking about how to meeting those objectives at least cost, and think really carefully about who's going to pay. And that's where Mark and his colleagues have been playing such an important role.
When it comes to this latest request, when could the CPUC make a decision on this?
You know, I will be honest, I'm not this year, certainly, but I have not been keeping close tabs on the exact dates of when these decisions are going to come forward.
And just for some context, we're talking about, you know, one proposed additional increase, which followed a recent approval of an increase. But this follows a series of ongoing rate increases in recent years, right, Meredith?
It does. And if you think about it, maybe we'll get into this in more detail later. I mean, PG&E set a goal back in 2021 to underground 100,000 miles of electric distribution lines. And so if they maintain that promise, we're going to be looking at more and more and more increases going forward. So this is not the last increase we'll be talking about, I don't think.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're discussing PG&E's latest request for a rate hike, which is on top of the one that was just recently approved and kicked in yesterday on January 1. Okay, Mark, I want to turn to you because you're with TURN. That is the Utility Reform Network. It's a ratepayer advocacy organization. You joined us following the CPUC approving a rate increase, which happened in November. And I'm curious, you know, what are you thinking now that there's another potential rate increase that could take effect later this year?
On December 30th, PG&E filed a notice that the actual increase for January is going to be $34.50 a month. So that's the latest update. Just 2 weeks after they got approval for their big rate increase, the $2 billion that they're asking for, in the newspaper when they printed the notice, it said the bill impact would be $24 a month. That is according to what PG&E published in the newspaper in their official notice. And the worst thing is they're asking for early collection. They want to start collecting March 1st of this year. The extra 24, which goes on top of the $34.50. Now, let me tell you, Meredith is absolutely correct that the way that utility regulation works is utilities are supposed to ask for money before they spend it, get permission and authorization before. But there's a big loophole now where utilities can spend the money first and come collect later. They can overspend. And so this $2 billion is money that was spent between 2020 and 2022. It's money already spent. And what TURN is demanding is that the CPUC has to do on-the-ground inspections to make sure that the right measures were taken in the right locations for the right results, or else they should not get a penny, because PG&E has a bad record of not doing the right thing.
Okay, so you mentioned $34.50 starting January 1 and potentially an additional $24 come this spring. So that's nearly $50 a month for ratepayers. That's like $600 a year. I mean, are there any measures in place to protect ratepayers, to protect consumers from significant financial burdens, Mark?
TURN is fighting for a cap on future increases. We have a campaign for affordable power, CAP, and the cap is set at the cost of living adjustment provided by Social Security. That should be the limit on how much rates should increase every year, and not double digits year after year after year, like Meredith was saying. In fact, this past rate increase was record-breaking. The reason Meredith thought it was bigger than anything she had seen is because it was the highest in history. And we just cannot keep doing that. It's not only going to cause more disconnections, more people being thrown into the streets, being pushed into homelessness because they can't afford their utility bills, but it's going to undermine California climate goals. Because when the price of electricity, and Meredith, she and her colleagues at UC Berkeley have documented that when the price of electricity goes higher than the price of fossil fuels, people are going to be resistant. Here's one thing people don't like. People don't like being punished for doing the right thing. People don't like the idea of, I'm going to get an electric stove, I'm going to get electric heat, a heat pump, and now I'm going to have to pay more every month. We're supposed to reward people for doing the right thing with lower bills, not punish them.
Meredith, you mentioned, it is just going to cost more. That is just a reality that we have to grapple with. But there's also, as Mark is highlighting, there's a societal cost as well. Are rate increases the only answer to this?
No. And I guess maybe if I can take a step back, because I think Mark raised some really important points that I want to draw out a little bit. I think this is all happening against this backdrop of a history in California of utilities, and PG&E in particular, starting wildfires, right? So 5 of the past 10 most destructive fires since 2015 were linked to PG&E's network. And regulators did find that in some cases, PG&E had violated state laws or could have been doing more, right? So against that sort of history, PG&E has acknowledged mistakes and said, we are making ambitious commitments to doing better. Doing better costs a lot more. So I think we can all agree that PG&E should be doing more. But there are these really high stakes disagreements about how much more and how we should approach this. So this approach to to undergrounding lines, I think on one hand sounds appealing, right? And PG&E's CEO, Patty Poppe, has argued that, there's no better way to reduce wildfire risk than to put them underground at a cost of $3 million per mile. And she's made this point, who wants to get on a plane that has a 35% chance of crashing, referring to the fact that other measures reduce risk by maybe 65-70% versus 100%. However, it's not a 35% risk, right? Even the most high risk lines, the risk of wildfire on a given day is still below, around 0.1%. So we're working with a low risk baseline when we're thinking about how much we're going to reduce. So I think Mark and other stakeholders have really been pushing back on this idea that undergrounding is the only way. There are other ways to mitigate risk. When you live in California, you have to live with some wildfire risk. We're not going to eliminate wildfire risk. And so I think there's a really important conversation about how much we should be putting into undergrounding versus fast trip settings or covered conductors or other tools we have to reduce risk. So that's one. The other thing is, so it's going to cost us money no matter what we choose. Mark's point is, how do we recover those costs? And why we're asking ratepayers to reduce wildfire risk is a question we should be asking, right? Why is that on the electricity bill versus the state budget? So, it's a really important question that we need to keep asking as rates keep climbing, right? We don't pay for other climate change adaptation investments on our power bills. Why is this one the key driver of rate increases?
Yeah, Mark. Okay. So, you're with an advocacy organization. How do you approach this from a legislative arm? Do you work with state lawmakers to try and see if you can get it into the budget and kind of offset the burden that ratepayers are shouldering?
There are a number of things that PG&E can do to reduce the ratepayer burden. One is they can apply for billions of dollars of federal funding for infrastructure for the wildfire mitigation, which they are refusing to do because it's not profitable. Because the way they're doing things now produces tremendous profits for Wall Street investors. So that's one. Two, like Meredith said, we can look, it is so much more fair to charge. Look at it this way. With utility bills, the lower your income, the higher percentage of your take-home pay goes into paying that bill. With the income tax system, the higher your income, the higher percentage you pay. And if you're low income and you get an earned income tax credit, you might be paying negative income tax because you're getting a refund. When's the last time you heard somebody get a negative utility bill in a month? Okay. So the point is that there are more equitable ways to be able to pay for things. Also, ratepayers should not be paying for electric vehicle charging stations. Let the transportation sector pay for that. Let the building sector figure out how to finance building electrification. The ratepayers have done their fair share, billions of dollars, to decarbonize the whole generation, electrical generation field. It's simply not fair. My final point on this that Meredith was talking about, the judge at the CPUC judge who issued the initial proposal agreed with Tern that insulating overhead power lines is faster and cheaper and just as safe as burying the lines. And so the CPUC, Public Utilities Commission, had an option to choose a faster, cheaper, and just as safe option, and they buckled in to PG&E executives and to Wall Street investors by choosing the slower, more expensive, and considerably more profitable option.
And when you say insulating the ones that are currently above ground, as opposed to actually, you know, moving, you know, as Meredith said, the initial goal of 100 or 10,000 miles underground.
10,000, yeah, that's right. Well, look, when you insulate overhead lines, you're doing two things. One is new lines that are insulated. So you're not insulating the existing, but you get brand new lines that are insulated, and you get brand new electrical poles that are also insulated because the current poles cannot carry the additional weight. Guess what? Insulated lines weigh more than bare metal lines, which is what we've got now. So you've got, I've seen these with my own eyes too. So you have brand new poles, they're insulated, and insulated lines. That's what makes them safe.
Yeah, PG&E is one of the largest utility companies in the country. It's certainly the largest in California. It serves like 16 million customers. It goes from like Bakersfield pretty much all the way up to the Oregon border. You know, is there a gold standard within California that we can look to? I mean, I know undergrounding has taken place with San Diego Gas and Electric. I mean, are other utility companies doing a better job, not only for safety, but also it being cost effective? Meredith?
I will say, PG&E is the biggest, right? 100,000 miles of electric distribution lines, more than, I think, 25,000 of those are in high-risk areas. So it is, in some senses, an unfair comparison to look at SDG&E and say it's costing them less when they have so much less area and less high fire districts. So I think the question, I'm willing to bet that the right solution involves some undergrounding in the highest risk areas. But I think we need to be thinking a lot harder because, as Mark mentioned or alluded to, PG&E does earn a rate of return on capital investment. So they have a reason to favor more capital investment undergrounding over some of these other options. So I think just what the CPUC has started to do, it really needs to lean into doing more of, which is scrutinizing the proposed response to escalating wildfire risk and making sure it strikes the right balance between safety, which we're all interested in, and affordability, which we have a moral obligation to be focused on.
Mark, I know you wanted to jump into this.
Yeah, I'd like to answer also. Southern California Edison is a good example. They have already insulated over 5,000 miles of overhead power lines. They plan to have 7,000 miles done by the end of 2024. Now, they just started this project a few years ago. So it cost them $800,000 a mile. So we know how much it costs, okay? And we know how fast it can be done. PG&E claims that it All the records, that, and that's actual. The actual amount PG&E has spent historically to underground lines is $4 million. Okay, I know that Patricia K. Poppe is claiming they can do it for $3 million. I am telling you the record shows $4 million is the actual, and the same as $800,000 is an actual. Okay, those are actual figures. And it's going to take them decades to get 10,000 miles. And when it comes to wildfire safety, when you live in a high wildfire safety zone, I know that you want your wires to be made safe within a couple years rather than 20 years.
Mark and Meredith, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Toney is the executive director of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, that is a ratepayer advocacy organization. And Meredith Fowley is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and the faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas. And as we mentioned, we did invite PG&E on the show and they were unable to join us. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.